Okay, today is Friday, November 22nd. This is the second interview with Bob Mitchell. We're here in his office in Ag Hall, and my name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Bob, as I said before we turned the recorder on, there were a couple of more questions I wanted to ask about your undergraduate time before we move on to your employment here at UW-Madison. So I'm always interested in where undergraduates hung out. I know you had a house near Mifflin, but what sort of, you know, restaurants or bars, things like that, did you and your friends hang out at?
Well, I guess I kind of went in two phases in my undergraduate time. When I guess the what I call the first phase, we went to, you know, when I lived over on Dayton Street, which is, you know, one, you know, close to Mifflin Street, we lived around the corner from the Nitty Gritty. The Nitty Gritty back then was about half the size. It was a very interesting bar because they had, you know, Marshall Beerley. He brought in a lot of really interesting bands, a lot of, you know, local name bands, and it was, so, you know, that'd be a pretty common place to go, especially on the weekend nights, and go down and hear some music and hang out. Wanted to get something to eat, we go to on Henry Street. It's still there. I'm sorry, I'm missing the name now.
I'm not able to help, sorry. So on Henry Street.
It might may come back to me. It's like, yeah.
Burger joint?
Burger joints. Yeah. Where the, I don't know what it is now. It's down there in the corner of Francis and State Street, but originally it was the Brat House.
Okay.
They had good burgers. Yeah, there was, and this place I can't remember on Francis, which may come to me at some point. They were also known for the, burgers. So,
okay.
That was common places to hang out in terms of bars in those days. What I'd call the second phase of my, time when I moved over to the Near East Side, then it was Mickey's Tavern was a pretty common one. It was, you know, because that was it's still there, but it was back then it was under different ownership, but it was just a kind of like a little Northwoods bar that was transplanted into Madison, into the down, you know, the southern part of the state.
Mm-hmm. What kind of music were you listening to in the 70s?
Well, I would just say just kind of the general, you know, I think of the 70s, a lot of the bands I think of are the 60s, but, you know, just a lot of the popular stuff, you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Jackson Browne and James Taylor and Carly Simon and
so the top 40 of the 1970s.
Yeah, we would never admit to it being the top 40, but I suppose it was the top 40. I don't know what the top 40 was. You know, radio was such a different format in those times. Mm-hmm. You know, The Who and all the bands that you hear now when you hear the 60s and 70s oldies shows.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like when the Eagles really started gotten going. I kind of didn't listen to music nearly as much or didn't pay that much attention to it as it came on. So I kind of like the late 70s and the 80s bands. Was kind of slipped by me. And so mm-hmm. when I hear 70s, late 70s and 80s oldies, it's new to me a lot of the time. I kind of like the stuff, but it's like, you know. Yeah, I like to listen to blues, too. That was just kind of, I hung around with a lot of guys and like to listen to, you know, Chicago blues type people, so.
Mm-hmm. Did you actually get Chicago blues bands coming up here to play?
They did come up here to play. I can't tell you, I went out to see a lot of them. I can remember a few of them. You know, John Lee Hooker came up here, and I believe Buddy Guy came up here, and yeah, they came up here. Places like the Nitty Gritty were that's the kind of place they would play. Mm-hmm. A lot of different kind of people play there, but they would play there sometimes.
Did you attend UW athletic events while you were undergrad? Football, basketball?
Not much. I grew up kind of in the shadow of Camp Randall. You know, I was, and I think I kind of burned out on the whole Camp Randall experience before college came along. You know, I lived in the, you know, it's like when I grew up, our cars would get parked in. We couldn't get out of the driveway because there were so many, the cars were parked in there, and it was just, yeah, I haven't gone to games to speak of for years. I usually watch them on TV now, watch football and basketball. But yeah, it's not, as a student, it wasn't a big part of what I did.
Okay.
I was more countercultural, and it wasn't really a countercultural experience. So there are plenty of countercultural people love the football. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's move ahead a few years anyway to. I guess 1982 and the job.
I got my job.
Yeah, so first off, how did you find out a job was available? Or do you remember finding out how you found out the job was available?
Yeah, I remember it well. I was living on the Near East Side in my first house in those days. My wife and my brother and I, we weren't married yet, but my soon-to-be wife and my brother and I owned a house together on Rutledge Street. And I was freelancing, and I was not looking for work, but I probably should have been because I was not making a lot of money, and I was kind of living off my credit card, and I enjoyed what I was doing, like the flexibility and everything. But so one afternoon, I was in my backyard building a fence. It tells you something about freelancing because when you could have been working, I was in the backyard building a fence. And then my wife's a former boyfriend of my wife's came by, and he was somebody who was he was out of work, and he's always looking for work, and so he's watching the university job boards, and he came over and said, "I found a job for you." Like I said, I wasn't looking for a job, but it was in the ag journalism department, and it involved writing, especially about all the topics they cover here. But back in those days, in particular, it was much more about agriculture and rural stuff. And we wanted somebody who could do that, and somebody who had some photography experience. And it was a pretty good fit for me, so I figured, why not? So I applied for the job and went through the interview and got the job.
Was it as simple as applying? They called you in for an interview. Was there a phone interview and then a face to face?
No, I was living in town. It was. I just came in for an interview. You know, dug in my closet and found a sport coat and went down, and they were in the old Ag Journalism building, basement of the Ag Journalism building, and they had a pretty good sized interviewing committee, you know, all of whom I got to know and was working with later on. But there was, you know, they interviewed a number of candidates, and so it was one interview. Mm-hmm. One interview after I did the application. But
where was the old, so in 1982, where was ag journalism?
Ag journalism was 440 Henry Mall, which is the Henry Mall face of the biochemical sciences building. So when they built the new biochemical sciences building, it's the middle building on the west side of Henry Mall.
Okay.
And it's a building that's like started on agronomy, and then it was genetics, and it was dairy for a while. Then ag journalism went there, and probably the late 70s, ag journalism used to be, when I was doing work when I was working in high school for Ag Journalism, they were based in the basement of Ag Hall where Landscape Architecture is now. So that got to be their building. So, and the whole time they were there, Biochemistry wanted to take it over. And Biochemistry finally got their way. But the price for that Ag Journalism got to take Ag Journalism also, those in that time, also had, I think you'd say that the first two floors of Hiram Smith Hall, which happens to be where they are now, their life science communication now, but they had, that was kind of our publication operation was over there. And then they had a print shop in the basement. We had the editors and designers had offices over in Hiram Smith Hall. I had an office in both buildings, two offices, and then we had a print shop downstairs and a mailing room downstairs. But the main Ag Journalism building was 440 Henry Mall.
Okay. So when you were hired and when you started, your office was in?
It was in both places. Okay. I had an office in both places. My main office was in Henry Mall, but I also had an office. I shared an office to start with in Henry Mall, and I shared an office in Hiram Smith Hall. And you'd go over to Hiram Smith Hall, and that would be where you'd go when you were doing editing, when you're working on publications. We did both news and publication work in those days. Well, I always have done news and publication work, but in that time it was a split operation. They had what they called departmental editors, where they had different people assigned to different departments in the college, and you did all the news and all the publication work for those departments. And my departments were life sciences communication and it was agricultural journalism, I should say, agricultural economics and rural sociology, and I think landscape architecture, and Cal's administration, and the ag research station. So those places had publications they needed done. I'd be the one who was supposed to get them done. Take care of those, and if they had news work, news releases, or public publicity, anything like that, I was supposed to do the publicity for those. So we had somebody, that was kind of the social sciences editor, we had somebody doing animal sciences, and had somebody doing plant sciences, and somebody doing natural resources, I think. We had about five departmental editors in those days.
Okay. And how different was the freelance work you were doing to the job you got?
I got a regular paycheck. That was hugely different. It's kind of the issue of freelancing is you might be getting a check right now, but if you're not doing something, writing something right now, then you're not going to get a check in a month, and so you're not going to. So there's always the concern that you can be really busy, but you're nervous because you don't know what you're going to do next, and you don't know if you're going to get paid next. So having the paycheck was huge. Type of work I did, I didn't do. I just did writing. I was mostly going out and doing on farm stories, visiting farms, and getting stories when I was freelancing. And when I was here, I'd go along, I'd work with different people, in the different colleges, and write stories, which we would mostly send out as news releases. And plus, I edited publications, which meant editing publications means you get the manuscript and you rewrite the manuscript, and then you kind of see it through. You work with a designer. You're pulling together photographs and overseeing, watching the design and proofreading and taking care of the publication. Back in those days, did a lot of publications. Extension did publications, and the research division did publications. It doesn't get done anymore. The publications that get done in large part, extension type publications like, how to manage your farm records or something like that. It gets done as a PDF and put online and gets downloaded online. So.
So are you saying there wasn't much of a learning curve between your work and your freelance work and then your work here?
writing is writing, and writing for that particular market is writing for that particular market. So there wasn't a huge learning curve there. Yeah, there was, you know, working with publications, you had to understand a little bit of how printing got done. And so, you know, we'd learned about that in school, but of course you never really learn that much until you do it. So I suppose the biggest learning curve was you had to learn the expertise in the areas that you were working with. You know, I'd talked to a lot of farmers over time, but I hadn't talked to a lot of agricultural economists that provide information for farmers, and so there's a lot of technical stuff. You know, I didn't know what a net worth statement was. You know, I didn't know how milk was marketed. I still don't quite get how milk is marketed, but I've kind of faked it for all these years. You know, how grain is marketed, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, that was the main thing. You know, just there was that, you know, working in the university, there's this wide range of topics, and so there's that. You have to learn that kind of stuff. And just figuring out the university is a big and complex place, especially when you're also working for, you know, for university extension, because that's a whole other thing, and just figuring out who works for who, and, you know, it's a much different culture, much different environment. That was probably the biggest thing to learn.
So did you have to become a generalist, learn enough about a little bit about a lot of different things?
Yes, yeah, sure. Which is, I think, why this job's always been a good fit for me, because it's an attention span thing, but it's you don't have to delve really deep and learn really. You don't have to become an expert to the sense that you can actually do a specific type of science. You just have to, you need to learn, but you have to be enough to be able to write about it. So you become a specialist in the sense that I didn't know that much about dairy and livestock for a number of years that I was here, because I didn't write about that stuff. You know, I worked with people who wrote about that stuff, and, you know, when you're writing about farm management, you're also writing about how to manage dairy and livestock operations. But I had a, you know, colleague down the hall, Bob Cooney, he wrote about dairy and livestock, and he was good at it, and he knew all the dairy and livestock guys, so, you know, that stuff I picked up later on. So, a generalist in the areas I was covering.
Right.
But, I mean, generalist, but I got expertise, so I could write about that stuff.
Okay. So, Bob, when you got this job, who did you report to?
There was a guy named Jim Griffith in those days. He was the guy they'd hired to be, I'd call him, communication director for the college. In those days, ag journalism was kind of the site of, there was the communication program for the college and the communication program for cooperative extension, and they'd hired, you know, they'd been through various organizational structures for doing that, but the guy named Jim Griffith oversaw it in those days. He was in charge of news and publications and photography, to whatever extent they could. The photographers were a pretty independent lot, but to whatever extent they could oversee them. And he was an academic staff person like me. It was a new thing for the college for that department to hire somebody, a non-faculty person, to oversee those kinds of operations. It had always been done by a faculty member in the past. In a way, it's kind of like the start of, like, now it's strictly a professional communication operation for the college and for extensions. Basically, they're professionals that come in to do communication. There was a, you know, that kind of shifted from a time when faculty members did a lot of the communication. You know, that was kind of the original model for it. Faculty members are people who worked for them, so.
And then you had colleagues that were peers of yours?
Yes, yes.
Who were some of them?
Kristen Merck did the plant sciences at first, and later on she got to be what we called the news editor. She was kind of in charge of editing everybody else's news release and sending out the news publications. Carl Gutknecht he started out doing our animal sciences stuff, and he was there for, I forget, first probably 3 years or something like that. He was nuts. He came back, and moved out to Idaho, worked in Idaho for a while, came back. You know, he's bounced around a lot of places. He edited the Wisconsin Agriculturist for a time. So, a guy named Jerry Mosier did our natural sciences work. He had a natural sciences background. I think his background was in bacteriology. So he did our, you know, did that stuff, the basic biology stuff.
So there were several.
I think there were 1, 2, 3, 5 departmental editors all together at any one time. You know, it kind of shifted a little bit. Or editors, probably 4 people with specific subject matter areas, and then 1 person who kind of was like the central person who edited stuff. And I think at that time, that person probably did a lot of the stuff for the central. For administration too, so like the student recruiting things and more of the centralized stuff.
Now, did each of you have people that reported to you?
No, that was the hierarchy. We had the guy, the Jim Griffith, who was the communication director, and then we worked for everything else. It was pretty flat from there on out. There were some classified staff, clerical people. But it was, you know, then there were also, I mean, those are the editors on the publication side. We had 2 or 3 graphic designers, and we had a person that kind of managed the publication operations, and we had somebody who did typesetting. Back in those days, you had a specific somebody who did typesetting and layout, because printing the publications was, well, everything was really different in those days. How everything got done, you had like a dedicated person doing typesetting.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, everybody basically keys it in themselves.
Right. I wonder if you wouldn't mind or talking us through that. By that, I mean, so let's say you're working with one of the departments you're tasked with, and they want a publication.
That would get done?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, basically they'd... depends whether it was one that was being revised, which was pretty common with extension publications, or done new for the first time. But let's say it was done new for the first time, they'd send you, you'd get a typewritten manuscript. You'd go through the typewritten manuscript and you'd mark that up with a, you just go through and you'd edit it on paper. And, you know, as best you could, it was a double-spaced manuscript. You'd make all the editing and rewriting and stuff between the lines, and then, you know, if it got to be really bad, you'd type up and retype the stuff that really had to be changed quite a bit, and you'd cut and paste that into the manuscript. So that's what you'd have. You'd have a stack of paper typewritten with a bunch of changes made on it, and you would send that over to the typesetter, and the typesetter had a, you know, sat in front of a screen and had a, they would clip your manuscript to a, you know, to a little stand, and he'd look at that, and he would type it in, he'd key it in, you would mark up the manuscript. If you want something to be bold-faced, you mark it a certain way for bold-faced. If you wanted to be italicized or anything like that, so he'd go through and he would put it in and he'd code it. You know, if he wanted to be bold-faced, there'd be a certain code he'd put in front of that and behind that, so that would be bold-faced, and he'd type it on a screen, which was, in those days, the only screens we had. The only thing we had was the closest thing we had to a computer. So he would do that, and then it would, that would somehow get, they had another machine that would actually print out long one-column strips of type. He would decide whatever length he wanted to have, but you'd say you wanted to be, you know, 1.5 inches wide, so we'd print out these long 1.5 inches wide strips of columns of type, and they'd take those and they'd cut them, and they'd come out wet out of this machine, kind of like a photograph, you know, these long strips of black and white types. So they'd cut them out and they'd paperclip them up to a clothesline to dry. And then they'd give them to the designer, one of our publication layout people, or graphic designers, and they had these pieces of cardboard, and they would paste those pieces of cardboard, and they would paste those strips of column into a layout. It would just look just like your whatever your what the final thing was going to be. They've had three columns. They just paced that. The boards they were working on had these very fine blue lines, so they could line them up. And the blue lines didn't show up when they got photographed, and so they paced them up that way. And they'd had oftentimes the subheads and stuff would be done differently. They'd be pasted in. They had waxing machines in those days. They'd run these strips of type through a waxer, which would put wax on the back, kind of a cold, kind of a sticky wax on the back of them. Then they would just rub that down. That would make that stick to the boards. They still had a bunch of contact cement and brushes and everything sitting around because it hadn't been that long since they made the switch from contact cement. When I was at my first job where we were doing publications, they were still using a lot of contact cement where they just put that on the back of it and paste it down. Then if they had to shift it around, they'd have to pull it up and squirt a little bit of, I hate to think what it was, probably acetone or something to melt that contact cement, pick me and put it somewhere else. And so that they'd lay it out that way. And so you'd have a board, you'd have a like 11 by 17 board for each, you know, two-page spread of whatever the publication was going to be, and you'd have as many of those as you needed. And then, of course, you'd go through and you'd proofread that, and if you found any errors, then they'd if there's a misspelled word, then they'd go in there with an X-Acto knife or a razor blade, and they'd cut out that word, and then the typesetter would go and just print out that word, and they'd paste that word back into the spot, or if they had to do a new paragraph or something like that. So everything was, if they wanted to shorten by a line, you could just cut out a couple of adjectives or something like that and just recut and paste and move that whole little piece up there. So yeah, it was a very time-consuming and very much slower way of doing things. And then those things would get photographed. They had a way of photographing those. They'd create these metal plates for offset printing. The photographs were done, I'm going to forget exactly how all of the stuff got done, but photographs got done separately. They were called separations. They would have like a, if it was just black and white, they'd just have, they were screened for dots. If it was a color thing, they'd have three separations, four separations. They'd have one for cyan, magenta, black, and the other one's escaping my mind, but basically the primary colors, and they would, each of those, though everything red in the picture would be one clear transparent sheet, except it had dots for where the red was supposed to print. And those get sent to the when you had these layout boards before the pictures were supposed to be, would just have a big red square where the picture was supposed to be, because red doesn't photograph. And then after they made the negatives, they would make separate negatives for the pictures and paste those into the same spot. So that's kind of a fast and dirty explanation of the complexity of printing. It hadn't been that long since they had letterpress type stuff. They had a lot of cases that had old type sitting around there, raised type and engravings and that they used to use for, this is like right before offset printing I wasn't there when they did it. I was around a lot of people who used to do letterpress, used to do the old stuff, newspapers, and they used to do it that way. And I was kind of like, people could tell you how it used to be, but I didn't. I missed that part of it. Mm. So I was on the cutting wave of technology then.
So, and you may have answered this, so once those boards were as correct as they were going to be, then those boards were shot?
Yes. They photographed those boards and got a negative. And then they took that negative and they had a way of putting the negative up against a photosensitive plate, and they would shoot the plate. It might have been a positive, but they would put the plate and the picture together, and they would basically run the light through that plate, kind of like you're printing it on larger something in a dark room. And the plate was like an aluminum plate, and it was photosensitive, and so it would be to the point where ink would stick to the parts of the plate, that where the type was supposed to be, where the light had hit. So that's, you would just see, and then they could wipe this stuff over the plate that was kind of red, so you could read it. They could imagine a silver plate, late about 11 by 17, and they'd wipe this red stuff over, so you could see what this was supposed to look like, what the layout was going to look like. It would be in red, and you could see the picture. If it was a black and white picture, you could see it. All on this aluminum plate. So when you did printing, you had, you know, you had one of these aluminum plates for every set of two pages in the entire thing. It used to be common, all the daily papers and everything had these aluminum plates. Sometimes in the old days, you used to go out and see people would take their cabins and they would sheet their cabins on the outside with these aluminum plates. I mean, this is off from what I'm doing, but I can remember being places and it's like they could use it for a lot of aluminum plates got used in that kind of thing. And every publication had to have this big oversized envelope that would have the negatives and the manuscript and the plates and everything in it, because if you were going to redo it, you'd pull that out again. So they had all these great big flat storage places. And so then they burned that plate, and they had small offset printing. They had a small offset printing shop in the first floor of Hiram Smith Hall. So they take that plate and they put that all into a roller. And that roller would there's an ink thing, and the ink, the press would put ink onto this roller, which would roll against that plate. When it rolled against that plate, it would pick up the ink from where the parts of that aluminum plate that were photosensitive that were supposed to pick up the ink would pick up the ink, and they would put that ink onto a blanket, and they would go from that blanket onto the page. So that's why they call it offset printing, because it goes from the ink roller goes onto the plate, and the plate goes onto this rubber blanket, and the blanket prints onto the page. So it's called offset printing.
So who? Not who. So roughly how long would this process take? I mean, is this a...
We need to make a publication.
Like a weeks and weeks from the time you actually have the text, at least in.
Are you saying like if we were actually efficient and weren't like delaying, because these things used to get, you know, they stacked up. It was a pretty slow process. Yeah, you know, it's once you do the layout. I mean, it's if everything was ready, if the guy was typing up the manuscript, you could. I mean, you know. Weekly papers did it this way, so you could do it on, you know, you could do it theoretically. You could go, you could make the plate, you could do the whole thing in a day or something. But, you know, once they started making the thing, it might have been a couple of weeks to get it to the point where it's ready to be printed. You know, that doesn't mean it took a couple of weeks for the whole process, but, you know, everybody had multiple projects going on, so.
And then did the actual printing happen on campus?
For the basic stuff, we had small offset presses, some small offset presses in the basement of Hiram Smith Hall, and so they do the really basic stuff, you know, the fact sheets. I don't think they did two color; they might have, but they had then Extension had a print shop on campus. They still do now. They call it Do It Printing, but they've got presses over. I think it's over on Murray Street now. But they had some more. You know, they would do more. They had bigger presses, and they did a lot of printing for people all over campus, and also for people from the state too. And if it was a fancier thing, a four color thing, then it would likely be contracted out to one of the state printers.
So we just talked about the big, sort of a big publication. Now how about, you know, a press release, which nowadays...
How we did a press release?
Yeah. Or something, you know, something small.
Yeah, well, a press release was basically you had, you know, you... I'm trying to think how we did our press releases. It was, I guess the process was similar in a sense. Everything we did was on a typewriter. You know, when I first came, I had a Selectric typewriter, which I thought was pretty cool. and we'd write it on copy paper on this cheap yellow flimsy newsprint type paper, and you'd write that, and then you'd edit it on, you know, mark it up and edit it to whatever extent you needed. So that was like a rough thing, and you would give that to the whoever was doing the news, our news editor, who would edit your stuff. Somebody always edited your stuff, and then it would go to a secretary. You wouldn't call them secretaries anymore, but it would go to a secretary. I'd have a secretary in the news office, and she would type it up, so you didn't get a clean copy of a double spaced, say two pages or three pages of whatever it was. Usually press releases were two pages or less, and so that clean copy would go over to the fast copy shop, and they would have like letterheads. So you'd have a letterhead that would say Cal's News. You'd have a letterhead for extension. We used to do columns for the county agent columns, or 4-H columns or plant columns. So we'd have a different letterhead for each of those. And so the people in the press room would take that letterhead and run our press releases on that letterhead. And these fast, so it was. It was before the days of photocopying, but it was like a really, really fast offset printing kind of deal. And so they would take that, and they would print out however many copies. We had a route sheet for every press release that had all the different types. We had multiple mailing lists, so we'd have, general farm, State Farm publications, general national farm publications, general media. You check off which of the mailing lists you want to. We had, livestock publications and garden publications, and I have a feeling in a lot of cases they were all the same publication. They were just on different lists. So we did, but you'd attach one of those to every press release, and that would go along with the press release to the print room. And then that would go to the, we had a mail room associated with the print room, and the mailing guys would they'd mail them out. So they'd send out every day. You'd mail out press releases to all these different publications, to all these newspapers and newspapers, statewide newspapers, everything from the Milwaukee Journal, the State Journal, to the State Farm papers, and sometimes the National Farm papers. It was an expensive, paper-heavy, time-consuming process, but that's how everybody did it.
We talk about one in particular, maybe one or two, because you mentioned in the little brief biographical sketch you sent me that you eventually became editor and coordinator of the Cal's Status of Wisconsin Agriculture Report.
Right.
Can we talk a little bit about what that is, and then how you came to be sort of in charge of it?
Well, put it in context. There was I came and worked here in the early 80s, and it turned out to be pretty fortuitous to me in the sense that a lot of my freelance work at the end was involved doing work for a magazine that was published by Alice Chalmers, so an equipment company magazine. And so I came here in the early 80s, and I can't give you the exact time, but the early 80s, 1983, around there, was a rough time for Wisconsin, for U.S. agriculture in particular. They went through a lot of people that bought been given loans for farmland on highly inflated costs of farmland. It was the value of the farms. The people had been loaning on the value of the farm, which was an inflated value in a lot of cases. And then those farm prices started to hit the skids. The land prices started to hit the skids, and there were suddenly a lot of farmers were in a situation where they. If they were having trouble making their payments, and a lot of people were what they call now underwater. There were a lot of farmers that their they were losing their farms. They're in danger of losing their farms. It was a farm financial crisis, and it was a pretty big nationwide phenomenon. It was, you know, they made movies about it, and so it was an interesting time for everybody involved in agriculture. It was an interesting time for everybody involved in agriculture extension, because half the time they got blamed for it, because, you know, they said that telling everybody they needed to get bigger and more efficient, and getting more efficient or getting bigger was like, you know, that was, they encouraged people to expand. I mean, this was the message that was getting a lot of time. They and the bankers and everybody were saying farmers need to get bigger, and all of a sudden they were getting bigger and borrowing, and then when they couldn't make the payments. So it was a big financial issue, and it was something that it caught up a lot of people in extension over that time. There was a lot of hand wringing, a lot of finger pointing, and so extension did a lot of things, you know, they related to farm financial stuff, and since I was the guy that was doing most of the farm financial things, I was connected to a lot of that. And 1985, I worked with a couple of economists quite a bit. The one I've worked with more than any, and I'm still working with him on the same project, is Ed Jesse. He's a dairy policy guy. He's retired now, but he's still pretty active. He's a dairy policy economist. He's a policy economist largely focused on dairy. And he had this idea, I think Bruce Jones, who's a farm management specialist now, he was probably an assistant professor in those days, and he was involved in it too, and they'd done a one-time marketing, and one-time departmental staff paper on basically the financial status of Wisconsin farming, I think that's what it was called. And it basically laid out what the situation was. It looked out, you know, it talked about the balance sheet, the average balance sheet for the state, net worth, you know, costs, and a lot of farm, a lot of statistics for farming, and it was well received, and so they got the idea of doing this on an annual basis, or at least they did one. This had started out as this paper, then they did one. I think it was 1985 or 1986. They did the first one. It was called the Status of Wisconsin Farming. Actually, done as a saddle stitch, probably 50-page book, and it had a introductory section, kind of looked back at what had happened over the past year, and looked at the macroeconomic stuff, and specific agricultural economic, what had happened over the last year. And then it gave out. It had information on the farm financial numbers, you know, including the agribusiness, the net worth, and so it's kind of like taking the status of what things were and then what the outlook was for the year to come. And it was pretty well received. It was an issue that everybody, there's, you know, a lot of the farm industry and the policymakers were pretty keyed into it at that point, and so they just opted to continue doing that. And so, you know, we started out doing it. It was typewritten by a word processing person in the Agriculture Economics Department, and laid out. So the, you know, the initial copies of it are all, you look at it, it's all typewritten. It's an offset printed book, but it was all typewritten and. So we started that in the early 80s, and we are working on, I don't know, probably about the 27th issue right now, this year. And it's almost, I've worked on every one of them. I've edited every word on every copy of them. Ed Jesse has served as the editor for almost all of them. There was a time when Ed was the college's extension, associate dean for extension, and when he was doing that, he passed it on to somebody else. So it was done for a couple of years by, I think, Randy Fortenberry, who was an economist for a long time, and then I think Fortenberry gave it up for a year or so, and so it didn't get done for maybe 1 year or 2 years, but then Ed came back and kind of took it over again. And so he's always been the subject matter person. He's assigned it, kept it going, made sure that everybody did what they're supposed to do, and it's always included a bunch of stuff in the front about kind of the general agricultural situation, and then got the specific stuff about different commodities. So there'd be one on dairy, there'd be one on crops, there'd be one on you know meat, livestock, and there's in later years they added one on fruits and vegetables, and then there'd always be a section on farm inputs and the costs, and then they're often the you know, as we went along, they started having special articles in the back of the book that talked about just various subjects that were, you know, that were important to talk about. So whatever might have been current things at the time, and we're working on the current version. Is going to be the similar kind of stuff. A lot of the same authors. Bob Propp was involved in writing for almost every one of them. Bruce Jones has been involved and contributed to almost every one of them. And Ed and I are writing a special article for the back, which is going to be about the revitalization of the Wisconsin dairy industry. Because consider over that period of time, the farm industry went through that farm financial crisis, and the state dairy industry went through this period where there was a lot of concern about Wisconsin, the future of Wisconsin dairy. In 1989, the milk production started to decrease. It kind of hit a peak then, and it went down for about the next 12 years. And well, there's a point where we got passed, where California passed us in terms of number of the pounds of milk, and passed us a number of cows, and a lot of concern about that. There were a number of different initiatives that were started. The first one was called the Dairy Task Force 1995, and you know, that Bob Kroc was a co-chair. These are all efforts. There's a long string of them, but just efforts to try to turn around the state's dairy industry. And I can't tell you we were responsible for it, but 2005, I think it was 2004, the milk production hit the... It got to its lowest point, and ever since then it's been rising every year, and we've been hitting records the last 3 years, I think. And so it's the state's dairy industry has really been this huge turnaround that everybody's pretty interested in. So we're trying to document that and talk about the factors, why that happened, what turned around the milk production, and what the future looks like. Is that sustainable? So that's kind of that whole project has been a kind of gone through this whole, it's paralleled this whole interesting upswing, downswing and upswing in the kind of the fortunes of the state ag industry and dairy industry in particular, which drives the state ag industry. So that's it.
So currently, you know, you said initially the first few were typewritten. What would this document look like today, or what did the last iteration of this document look like? You know, how big was it actually printed?
It's actually printed. Nowadays they print these things on, they're basically high-speed laser printers, you know. But yes, it's printed. Although when we first were doing this thing, we'd print about 1,500 copies of it, and now we print about 700 copies, and a lot of those don't necessarily get used, but we have them for various things because they get done as PDFs and put up as PDFs. But looks much better. There was a point at which we shifted over to, you know, there's a point at which typewriting gave way to word processing, and word processing initially looked a lot like, probably those first ones, I say typewriting, they may have been word processed, but the word processing looked like typewriting because it came off these dot matrix printers. And then word processing started to look a lot more like typesetting because you could do stuff in Microsoft Word and makes it look, you know, was basically more like desktop, was the beginnings of desktop publishing. And over time it got to be more, as a result of that, got to be more, looked a little better in the design. And then there's a point probably about 8 years ago, Ed came over and he asked, he was looking for more help, and so we got my longtime colleague here, Diane Deering, she's been a designer here the whole time I've been here, and got her involved. And so we started basically doing it more like a publication. Of course, you know, we're way past the typesetting at that point. It's, you know, she's like, everything gets, you get the manuscript and fed into your computer, and she just sets the font and everything. But it, so it's laid out by her, and then she does a lot of work. You know, originally there are a lot of graphs in an economic publication, and they were pretty basic graphs, and now they're done pretty much more nicely. And we went to a color cover with a photograph on the cover, so it looks pretty slick. It's still a very bare bones publication in the sense it's not a magazine, it's not laid out, it doesn't have photographs inside, it's got a lot of graphics because there's a lot of, you know, numerical information, but there's a nice cover on it and it looks more substantial.
Great, thank you. Maybe talk about one more publication today to wrap it up, and again, you listed this in your brief biographical sketch, and that's the Cal Quarterly, I think, and Science Report.
Those are two different publications.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Cal's Quarterly and then the Science
Report. Then the Science Report, yeah. Cal's Quarterly started about the time I started here. That was an eight page tabloid-sized publication. A tabloid, like a newspaper-style publication. And we called it the Cal's Quarterly, and I don't think it came out quarterly more than 1 year out of the whatever 20 years we did it. It's my advice to anybody going on in the future. If you have a publication, never name it after a frequency it's supposed to come out. So, but it was basically alumni publication, Cal's alumni and stakeholders, and it was a lot of our stories, press releases, or stories that we did specifically for the publication. It had nice photography because we always had a good photographer, and so it was. It covered, it was news about the college, but as much as possible we tried to make it news about the science that's going on in the college, you know, more so than, you know, what's happening to different people in the college. There would be stuff in the back of it, you know, like who won awards, who's retiring, who, you know, who passed away, that kind of stuff. So it was kind of news like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, so yeah, that was, we did that. Probably when I first came here was, I think, the second issue of it I was involved in. I was in charge of it most of the time. There was a time when it got, when some other people took it over, and then it came back to me when some people retired, or when the ones people doing it passed on. And we did that, so probably from about 1982 until, I think our last issue was probably around 2006 or something like that. So,
so that's the Cal's Quarterly?
That's the Cal's Quarterly.
And you, go ahead.
Cal Science Report, every agricultural college, every college in general always seemed to be doing a magazine, and all the other colleges are doing magazines, and so there was always a lot of questions, is it really worth the effort and time to do it? But back when Neil Jorgensen was dean, he was dean twice. He was like dean when Leo Walsh retired. He was interim dean, and then he was after Roger Weiss, who was the dean after Leo left, then Neil became dean again. I can't remember which of those times it was, but the Neil really wanted to have a magazine, wanted the college to have a magazine. So we debated doing a, you know, periodical, true periodical in the sense, a couple times a year, three times a year, whatever, and we just settled for an annual one. So it's called the Science Report, and this was... probably the longest it ever got to be was about 40 pages, and it was longer features, probably anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 words, four-color publication with nice large photographs, and so longer stories about specific research that we really wanted to highlight. So, you know, it was written by the same people, by our editorial staff, and we tried to cover the waterfront, basic biology, and animal, plant, livestock, agriculture, the social sciences, and stuff. But we just tried to feature some of our bigger stories, or take a broader look at some of the stories instead of doing like a, you know, one story about one finding. It might be more about the findings over a period of time. So we started doing that in the early 90s. We did that for. Probably until about, I think that would end around 2006 as well. It was essentially, both of these were basically supplanted by the by Grow Magazine, which got started in the mid 2000s. science report started out being an every year thing, and then we finally started making it every other year because it got to be a lot of work and took a lot of time away from other stuff, and I think we just decided that it wasn't, it was cutting too much into our the other work we were doing, so. But it was a nice looking publication.
I think it might be a good place to wrap up today. We didn't really go chronologically in a sense. You know, we sort of talked about how things got done in the 80s and a couple of these quarterlies. But is there anything on your mind as we've been talking that you want to make sure you get it on the record?
Well, it's pretty remarkable over that period of time. I talked about how that was a time when things changed tremendously in agriculture. It's hard to think back to what, even talking here, to what the tools we used were back then to the tools we're using now. I mean, that was a time when, like I say, the only screens we had anywhere on campus were the ones used by our typesetter. And, you know, we got our first basic word processing systems in the, probably in the second part of the 1980s, we had these dedicated word processing systems that not too many people on campus had. We managed to get them. They were like, you know, they had a central server here, and it was what they call a dumb terminal. But they were still really basic things. And then I can remember probably when we first started doing the science reporters, or soon around there, when we first got our first Mac computer, which we didn't all have them, but Diane had a Mac computer, and we started doing the layout on those, and like I'd be leaning over his shoulder, and we'd be just making decisions on that. And then going on to, you know, the point where everybody got their various, went through all the various iterations of desktop computers, which were, I mean, they're usually Macs for us, and we started doing, we basically ended up doing more of our, taking on more of the layout and everything, and but it's, you know, even compared to that now, it's like it's been probably, I'm trying to think how many years it's been since we sent out a paper press release. I'm sure we haven't sent one of those since the early 2000s. Originally, there got to be a point where they would fax the press releases because the reporters didn't want to get them on paper anymore, and we didn't want to send them out. And then they got to the point where now they're all being emailed. And you know, a lot of the publications now, if they get printed, they get printed in very small runs. They get done as PDFs and emailed to everybody by way of PDFs. And but I think even more now, it's, you know, the journalism industry has changed so much. There's so many fewer reporters, and they're operating, they're covering so much more stuff, and you know, the social media has gotten such a huge piece of it. People are, you know, all the reporters blog and tweet, and so we've got somebody on our staff now that spends like a day out of our week just doing social media, Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and stuff like that. So it's, and we all do it, but you know, she does it more, so it's, you know, it's hard to even think back to how different it was, what we're doing now, how we're doing it then. It's it's just such a, you know, back then we made films. We had a nationally regarded documentary filmmaking unit, a small unit, but it was, you know, now we're doing videos on our phones and posting those on YouTube, so it's been an interesting evolution.
Well, Bob, I want to thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it. So this concludes the second interview with Bob Mitchell.